Drodzy Państwo, ja za chwilę zapowiem. Po polsku. Wykład będzie w języku angielskim, nie w hebrajskim i jeszcze nie w polskim, aczkolwiek, jak sądzę, dla pani ambasador nie byłoby najmniejszym problemem mówić w języku polskim, ale jest onieśmielona taką ilością życzliwych.
It's my wife, I'm sorry. Maniusiu, ja zapowiadam. It's my wife. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great, great pleasure. It's a great, great day. It's a great, great moment. This is the 8th or 9th, I don't remember, actually, days of a 28th edition of the Jewish Culture Festival in Krakow, which actually looks for me like a festival in the universe, the Polish-Israeli Jewish universe. So I think that we are creating something special over here. So don't trust the world surrounded you. This is virtual world. The real world, which we created together, is over here in Krakow. In Krakow, together with our Jewish and Israeli brothers and sisters. Before I introduce you, she doesn't have to be introduced, but I will do it, of course. We have also the, do you know that? Or maybe you'll be surprised, Anna. We have a special guest. She just arrived. She left Knesset. She left Ministry of Foreign Affairs. She left her husband, her family. She wanted to be with us. Ofra Ben Yaakov. Ofra Ben Yaakov from Ministry of Foreign Affairs, a friend of Ambassador to Israel, and Mrs. Anna Azari. By the way, Ofra is a great, great friend of mine whom I tried to convince from the 19th century, actually, to come. Please come to Krakow. Please come to Krakow. Please come to Krakow. Here she is. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a great, great honor to host today the ambassador of Israel to Israel in Poland, Mrs. Anna Azari. Please welcome her very cordially. And Mrs. Ambassador is going to speak about, I think, a long, long way which we have worked together since 1948, when the State of Israel was created, along to the way and the road of Zion and Zionism. And as you can see, the main theme of the festival is Zion. Not exactly specifically Zionism. However, the Zion means a lot for us and hopefully for you. So I would love to thank you again for coming to Krakow. And please, the floor, the chair, the microphone, the whole world is your Mrs. Anna Azari.
Dzień dobry. Będę mówić po angielsku dzisiaj, dlatego że tak umówiliśmy. Ale potem spróbuję, jeśli będą pytania po polsku, nie ma problemu. Okay, go. Zaczynamy z tego... English. Okay. We are starting with the same issues, more or less, and obviously it's not very serious to do 70 years of Israel, and I'm doing a much longer period because I'm trying to do a beginner's course what preceded Israel, but really, 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 really quickly for people who grew up in communist countries, the word Zionism was often some kind of a curse. a bad word which you are not supposed to use. It's something probably secret and ugly. And Zionism comes from the same word, Zion. As far as I know, there are 70 names for Jerusalem in the Bible. One of them is Zion, one of the more known one, and that's where the movement, the national movement of return of the Jewish people to Israel takes its roots. It's a national movement which started to be created on the backdrop of what was going on in all the countries here in Europe, 1848, the Spring of Nations, when the idea of national state starts to flourish or starts at least its first steps in Europe. The first ideas are coming up to the Jewish people as well, because traditionally or religiously, the Jewish people were waiting for the Messiah to come again to bring them back to the land of Israel. And one of the this guy with a beard who has a street in every Israeli town, Theodor Herzl, was the founder of the political movement, of the structure of Zionism. The first Congress of Zionist Congress is happening in Basel, in Switzerland, in 1897. And that's, let's say, the beginning, which will at some point lead to the creation of the State of Israel. I'm not giving you a talk on the different modes of different options of what kinds of Zionism we had, because I think we did it a year ago or something. But there was a way through international decisions to creating the State of Israel. One of the main ones was the Balfour Declaration, which happened a year and something ago. A year and something ago, we celebrated 100 years of the declaration. It's one of the first international statements about the right of the Jewish people to return to Zion. And then we very quickly skip to the thing itself. We are talking about the UN decision to create two states on the territory of the British Mandate for Palestine. We're talking about 29th of November 1947. On one hand, this is the decision from which, at least legalistically, Israel starts. On the other hand, this is the decision, this is the date, more or less, from which the War of Independence of Israel starts, which means that the War of Independence for Israel started before Israel was declared, because the Israelis on the Jewish side of this decision, the Israelis agreed to this decision and to the very, very bad borders which were written into this international UN decision. The Arab side didn't agree, and that's the start of the war. The interesting thing, or quite an impossible, a lot of the things around it are quite impossible and quite miraculous, I would say, that the Jewish population of Palestine under British mandate around this time was somewhere around 600,000 people. It's very few, and they immediately stand under attack of the neighboring countries and of the Arabs, Arabs inside inside Palestine. By the way, the word Palestinian as a separate concept came much later. At this point, there was talk only about Jewish side and Arab side.
Soviet Union, yes. The United Kingdom, abstain. The United States, yes.
Mention of the Death Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
At this point, Palestine had more or less 67% of non-Jewish residents, mostly Arabs. The British leave the territory. I remind you, the British held the international mandate in Palestine for that monument. They leave their weapons to the Arab side. And on the Jewish side, we have the 600,000 who are already there. And we have waves, at first, waves of immigrants, mostly Holocaust survivors coming to the country and coming immediately into the fight. It's very... very sad stories stem from it, because sometimes people were not even registered in any recognizable war. They survived the Holocaust, they went into battle, and sometimes they died without us even having them necessarily registered. Now we will move to the Declaration of Independence, just a moment. Ben-Gurion had the first prime minister of Israel and the leader of the Zionist organization of the Jewish structure before the state was declared, had a very hard choice to make, because no, it was completely unclear who is going to win this the war, which was already around them, and can he really declare a state? Is it going to be sustainable even for the first months? There was an argument. The military assessment was that it's 50-50.
May 14th, 1948, 4 p.m. Tel Aviv. On a small podium stands a determined Zionist leader before a hastily convened gathering, reading out a proclamation which would change the course of history. This is how the State of Israel was born. First, a bit of background. At the end of World War I, the Allied powers gained control over the Middle East, including the Land of Israel. The League of Nations recognized the historical connection of the Jewish people to their land and granted Great Britain a mandate to help them reconstitute a national home. However, Arab riots and geopolitical considerations led to a series of British restrictions on Jewish development and immigration. Even ships, including displaced children and Holocaust survivors, were sent back to Europe. Jewish resistance grew as well. By 1947, the ball was back in the United Nations court, where a majority of the nations decided on November 29th, after a tense vote, to divide the land into a Jewish and an Arab state. The Jews rejoiced. The local Arab population, well, they launched a war throughout the country. May 15th, 1948 was the date the British mandate officially ended, the date the Jewish state was to be declared, and the date five regular Arab armies planned a coordinated attack to annihilate the newborn state. On May 12th, David Ben-Gurion convened the People's Council. The atmosphere was grave. Moshe Sharet reported that the Americans are demanding a postponement of the declaration, or else they would not help Israel against the United Arab invasion. Golda Meir reported that King Abdullah had retracted his original agreement and will join the attack. Military leaders expressed serious doubts about the ability of the small Jewish community to withstand 5 regular Arab armies equipped with European weaponry. But somehow, after 13 hours of deliberations, Ben-Gurion succeeds in swaying the balance against the American demand. And on Friday, May 14th, in the presence of local Jewish leaders, he declares the establishment of the State of Israel. The proclamation, which was inspired by the American Declaration of Independence, asserted the historical and moral rights of the Jewish people in its historic homeland, and defined Israel as a Jewish democratic state based on equal rights, freedom, and justice. The declaration ended with a call on Jews to return home and extended a hand for peace towards the local Arab population and neighboring Arab countries. The Arab invasion was immediate and lasted for over a year. Close to 50% of Israel's small fighting force were survivors of the Nazi death camps, who vowed never again. 1 out of every 100 Jews living in Israel died in the fighting. But by the end of the war, the small Jewish state had emerged victorious as an independent nation in this homeland for the first time in 2,000 years.
Well, conceptually, Israel is a very, it was and it still is a very unique kind of country, because from its inception and to this very day, this country is on one hand a regular country which is supposed to give to be a home to its inhabitants and to promise them a safe and a normal life. On the other hand, conceptually, this home was created not only for the people who are already in it, but for the people who, for Jewish people all over the world. The idea, which is that's the base of the Zionist idea. This is the law of Israel, in which we have a law of return, which allows anyone who has Jewish roots, to the same extent to which they were, the Jewish roots were enough to bring them to the neighboring Auschwitz, to the same extent, more or less, Israel accept anyone with Jewish roots as its citizens, a citizen, especially in an hour of need. Now, the situation during the first months and years of Israel was very interesting, very hard and very hard to understand, because just in 18 months the Jewish population grew from 650,000 up to 1.3 million. It's very interesting for those of us following the current argument about migration, immigrants, refugees in Europe, how complicated it would be to accept basically another 100% of in numbers of population and to absorb it. But it was exactly what happened. Now, I already mentioned the Holocaust survivors who came from the Holocaust from Europe and directly into this country, and very often directly to fighting. On the other hand, there was a huge population of Jews from Arab countries, and from also some of them not only Arabs, some Iranians as well, but coming who were real refugees. I'm talking about Jews from Morocco, Jews from Iraq, and so on. You have to understand that the moment the UN declaration was accepted, and the moment the state was proclaimed, the Jews were basically kicked out or declared unwanted. So the people came without any kind of any money, any no stuff. You had hundreds of thousands and millions of people coming who were, in our contemporary terms, refugees. This the difference is that on the Palestinian side, we still are talking about refugees. You will not be hearing today about Jewish refugees in Israel, because we don't have Jewish refugees in Israel, because the people were accepted in Israel, integrated in Israel, became Israeli citizens, while most of the Arab refugees from Palestine during the same war who moved to other Arab countries were kept in refugee camps and were not given citizenship or rights. So we have the situation of refugees even in fifth, sixth, or whatever, maybe it's not fixed, sixth, fourth generation on the side of what we now call Palestinians. Now, going to back to the state of Israel, what was going on economically? We are talking about a very basic situation at that stage. A lot of the economy based on agriculture, and probably the symbol of Israel for many, many years, this were those Jaffa oranges. It was a brand name, very popular and known for Israel, and it was one of our main export in the country. One of the most unique creations of the Zionist movement, not only of Israel, because kibbutz movement starts before Israel. It's one of the streams of Zionism. We had, again, I'm not giving a lecture on Zionism, but we had different directions of Zionism. We had political Zionism. We had right-wing Zionists, and still have, by the way, left-wing Zionism, midstream Zionism, bad, good, whatever you want. The kibbutz, which is different than Peger in Poland or kolchoz, or kolchoz in the Soviet Union, was a result of the socialist Zionism and socialist ideas. The main difference, of course, between any kind of a structure in communist countries and the kibbutz, that the kibbutz was voluntary. You never send anyone forcefully to the kibbutz because the state decided to do that. But it was a very interesting structure of dividing property, raising children together, and trying to create some kind of social justice in one place, one, if you would call it a village, I'm not sure it's the right name. But it's very hard for me always. Why do I put the kibbutz here when I don't have any time and I omit quite a lot of things from the 70-year story? Because I don't think that without kibbutz and without moshav, which is another sometimes semi-socialist way of building new agricultural settlements, I don't think that we would be able to keep the state and keep its borders. This map shows the numbers of kibbutzim which we have, and as you see, they are almost following the pre-6-year war border of Israel. They were extremely important for keeping this country alive. To this day, we have around 270 kibbutzim, but a lot of them are kind of, I would say, privatized or unsocialized in a way. But still, some of them, usually the richest, are keeping this structure in each every one of equality and complete sharing. Now I'll try to quickly touch foreign policy building of Israel. First of all, how come Israel got an international support altogether? And first of them, I call it Stalin's mistake. Stalin, knowing that the Zionist movement has in it a strong, actually ruling socialist component, David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, is a socialist, made a mistake. He was sure that if he supports the creation of the creation of this Jewish state, he will have another state for the communist bloc. Well, David Ben-Gurion maybe was socialist, but he wasn't stupid, so he never had an intention of to become a member of the socialist bloc under Stalin. But Stalin did make a mistake, and it was crucial for the survival of the state. First, because he decided to give... he decided to vote for Israel when I'm talking not about the vote I mentioned before, but about a recognition of the state of Israel after it was declared. Stalin decides that he's voting. When Stalin decides he's voting, it means all the communist bloc and a lot of other places in the world watching, including, of course, Poland. The second thing he does, and it's part of the same mistake, but it was crucial for our survival, is the decision to allow the Zionist movement and later on this very, very young state to get weapons from Czechoslovakia, which were critical to for us to win. Win the war. Well, I don't have it on the slide on this picture, but we have a very funny. We had help from a very funny source on the American side, and now I'm again talking not about. I'm not talking about presidents and governments. I'm talking about. Getting weapons or help in getting weapons and getting money, and it's an interesting story because it was the Jewish component of the American mafia, which helped the Zionist movement to get very needed, very critical money for purchase of arms. It could have been a movie or a story or a lecture on its own, because the person who did it was, his name was Meir Lansky. He was kind of finance minister of the mafia in the United States at that time. And the sad story of it, he was the one who helped both get the weapons, get the money, and so on. But the sad story about it is one of the single Jews who didn't get Israeli citizenship under the law of return. The guy came to Tel Aviv. People even remembered him walking his dog on the beach, but the decision was, because there is a clause which prevents from giving a citizenship to criminals and so on, and Lansky is not getting Israeli citizenship and eventually leaves, so it's a kind of bittersweet. A bittersweet story of the beginnings. We were definitely ungrateful in this particular case. Just a moment. Now, the first embassies that the state is opening are in a surprising sequence, but let's see this little movie.
הראשונה, ואז תימצא מדינת ישראל במחנה העמים החופשיים בעולם. יהודי ורשה קיבלו בתשואות את חברי הצירות לפני משכנם במלון בריסטול.
For those of you who recognize the Bristol Hotel in Warsaw, that's the first Israeli embassy opening ever in the world. That's the first since the government was socialist, they were not called ambassadors, they were called ministers plenipotentiary, Barzilai, and I'm happy that I'm here after the solution of history law, because now we will be able hopefully to revive our plan to maybe reproduce together with the Polish government this ceremony in September, because this happened on the 26th of September 1948, exactly 70 years ago, and we, since Bristol Hotel is in place, we hope to be able to reproduce ceremony again. But it's very typical of the first government of Israel, because half the government spoke Polish, the other half of the government spoke Russian. So the first three embassies, the very first three embassies which are being opened are Warsaw, Moscow, and Prague. Prague, of course, because of the, among other things, about because of the weapons from Czechoslovakia, things, which doesn't mean that we didn't have relations with the rest of the world, but it's very typical for the way. It's much easier to imagine these people. Now, back to this strange or unique idea I mentioned before, of a country which is built both for its population, but also in order to save Jewish population around the world. And I am giving here a list of operation. It's better to see the pictures. We are talking from the very beginning of the state. You remember I said that we are starting with 600,000 people. For one of the first operations, Magic Carpet, bringing people from Yemen, 1949. Now we will. I will give a bit. Ezra and Nehemiah operation, 130,000, 1951, 1952. Completely crazy. People don't have a serious industry, don't have a serious serious economic base, and making, really helping and actively acting to bring people not according to their contribution, to future contribution, but for the very fact that they are in enemy countries and they need help. And then I will skip to Ethiopian Jews, which we had two very different operations to bring Jews from Ethiopia. Jews from Ethiopia are obviously, you know, PC, politically correctly in America, it's supposed to be black Americans, no? African Americans. I don't know what's the PC thing for African Jews, but it's a very, very, very old community, because the tradition says that they are the descendants of King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. And the first operation was going on in 1984, 8,000 people, horrible story, because they went on foot through the desert, through Sudan, and then flying to France, and then flying to Israel, and a lot of the people died on the way. And the second operation, which we remember very well, is 1991, when there was civil war in Ethiopia, and Israelis... No, go back, please. And Israelis are evacuating in a long weekend around 14,000 people on planes. If you see this upper left side picture, that's how a plane looks when you take out of it all chairs and all everything in order to push as many people as you can and bring them over. That was called the Solomon Operation Solomon of bringing, because of Solomon and the Queen, of bringing the people to Israel. Now, something which was mostly ongoing but and very interesting, and I myself am as someone who was born in Lithuania, and a result of this fight was letting the Soviet Jews leave into Israel. It was mostly a political operation in demonstrating around the Western countries for the Soviets to let people leave the Soviet Union. And almost every Western leader who came to Moscow for anything else was equipped with a list of people who are requesting to leave and so on, and thousands, hundreds of thousands Israelis, new Israelis came from the Soviet Union, still under the Soviet rule. I'm not talking about the big wave of immigration after the Soviet collapse. There is always still somewhere in the air the question of if Palestinians are refugees, aren't the refugees, the Jewish refugees from Arab countries, in a way, at least they were refugees, and aren't they supposed to get some compensation for that? I will not discuss too much the many wars which Israel have, even though it's very hard to understand Israel and Israelis without understanding the permanent state of war which happened in Israel. I'm mentioning more traditional wars, later wars. Maybe part of you remember. Well, one of the worst of them was, or the worst of them was, of course, the War of Independence, because losing 6,000 people out of 600, it's a completely crazy war. We had back to remind you Stalin and his mistake. We had a war which was called the Suez Operation in English, which was an interesting story because it was an operation led by Israel, France, and Britain together, which is very strange for Soviet bloc, so communist country Stalin hoped for, but we had it. 6-day war, which brings Israel to its current undecided borders, including a big number of Palestinian population. 6-day war was a huge success of the Israeli army, but it's a political issue which was not resolved until today. When we are talking about two-state solution, we are always talking about an ability about an option of a Palestinian state on part of the territories which were taken by Israel in Six-Day War. And then the next critical war was Yom Kippur, or the Day of Atonement War, which was very traumatic for the Israelis because it was the first war after Six-Day War where Israelis could understand that there is an option of real danger for Israel, even when you have the army. It's not, sadly, that this was the last war, because we had a war in with Lebanon, and we have sadly enough operations or wars, or I don't know how to call them, once in a while with the Gaza sector, with attacks from Hezbollah in the north. But I'm not going to go into listing all of it. I would rather go to another fight, which was the fight for peace, and is the fight for peace in Israel. I picked here two pictures, not because those are the only ones, but because they are very symbolically important. First of all, it's President of Egypt, Anwar Sadat, who arrived in 1977 to Israel, and his arrival and the talks afterwards led to signing a peace agreement which returned all of the Sinai Peninsula to Egypt. The sad part of the story is that the two pictures, which deal with two different negotiation sets, one with Egypt, one with the Palestinians, have something in common, because under here, we are talking about a Prime Minister of, down here, sorry, again, up there it's Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin. Down here, it's Prime Minister of Israel, Yitzhak Rabin, and the head of the Palestinian Authority, Yasser Arafat. The common thing between the two pictures, I would say, is that both Sadat and Rabin were killed by people who were against their work on their own side, which means that President Sadat was, if I'm not mistaken, killed by Muslim Brotherhood people in Egypt, and Yitzhak Rabin was killed by a religious Jew who was against his agreements with the Palestinians. I have the mention of the other operations happening in Gaza, but where do we stand now on this what I call fight with Israel? Well, we don't. I don't see much happening. You know, all of us are, among other things, also newspaper readers. So once in a while, you have another kind of indirect negotiation happening. Now this last week we had representatives of the Trump administration trying to talk with Saudis, Israelis, Jordanians, and Palestinians. To say that it looks very hopeful right now, that we are on the brink of some kind of a new peace agreement, I'm not a prophet, but it doesn't exactly look like it, for different reasons. One of them is that on the Palestinian side, you have quite a deep division between the Hamas terrorist organization in the Gaza sector and the Palestinian Authority, which is also not problematic. When we are talking about a two-state we are talking about two states for two peoples, and not about three states for two peoples. In any case, right now, the leadership probably on both sides, doesn't look like leading to a quick solution. But I'm really, I really hope that I'm wrong. Because there is a famous story about our ambassador in Washington back during the Oslo agreements in the 90s, Itamar Rabinovich, who met a couple of professors in an airport. You know, ambassador to the United States, he was kind of looking down on the other guys who were flying to Oslo. And I hope that there are secret discussions which I don't know, but I'm not sure about them. Well, I'm skipping very quickly in order to come to some kind of a dialogue and not only of a not only a monologue here, trying to understand where we stand today. And from my perspective, it looks quite miraculous. First of all, Israel is today a nation of 8.5 million people, with around 6 million Jews among them, which is, or even more, 6.5, which is quite an amazing number considering the beginnings in 1947-48. Israel's GDP growth was 3.8 in last year, and we have a GDP of almost $36,000 per capita, which is a nice European GDP, considering the fact that we got there through wars and hardship. It's quite impressive. Not yet. A couple of weeks ago, there was some momentary happiness in Israel because apparently Israel passed Japan, which was always considered to be one of the most progressive, economically progressive countries in the world, on GDP per capita, and it was kind of a mini celebration for 2 seconds. Like, you know, the news cycle in Israel is much, much, much quicker than I think almost anywhere. We are one of the explanation of this is creativity, technology, innovation, which is becoming a very serious part of our economy. It depends on the list. You know, you can pick and change, but we are on number 2 or 2nd on the list of most innovative countries, 16th on one of the list on best competitiveness report. The one list which I like the most, and I never understand why, is I don't know how scientific it is, but once a year you have the happiness index. And when I see that on top of the this year on top of the happiness index, we had Finland. And it's clear to me why in Finland or Denmark, which is often there, would be on top of the happiness index. They're advanced countries with social infrastructure, with very good, it's always very indicative, very good situation on gender equality, and why not? But why Israel is somewhere, always somewhere between 9th to 11th place on this world happiness index, it's very hard for me to comprehend, because we have so many problems, but apparently we somehow feel happy, notwithstanding, maybe because of the strengths of our family structure, our family and social structure of the country. But I don't know the explanation anyway, where we are in a nice place on the happiness list. Back to technology, we are considered to be, in absolute terms, not in comparative terms, second place after Silicon Valley for innovation in the world. We have a completely Israeli ecosystem of innovation. Probably it comes from mostly from chutzpah and some kind of lack of borders, because in order to innovate, you are supposed to be ready to make mistakes. In more traditional cultures, it's usually harder. I wanted to bring one example, which is sounds like completely fantastic, but one of the the technological Israeli dream of many companies is an exit, which means you create a startup, then you build a company, and then your company starts earning, and then some huge company is buying you out. One of the really spectacular cases is the company, which is Mobileye, which was purchased a year something ago for 15 billion, billion, not million, dollars. This is a kind of purchase which changes, gives good numbers for the whole country for the whole year. And we do have these exits over and over again, and basically we could describe Israel as an economic miracle. Most of it was built before we had anything which you can dig from the ground or get from nature. When Israel found gas around it in the sea next in its waters, probably I was the only person who was sad, because back then I was ambassador of Israel in Moscow, and I was looking around me, seeing what happens to a country when you have this faucet with money called oil or gas, which is running. You are killing all the technologies. We did find gas, and it doesn't seem to be happening in Israel, so I was wrong, and the people who were happy for finding gas in Israel were right. But it's very interesting. In Israel, Israeli government works really hard not to let this oil economy happen in our country. It seems to be working out. Filmic no. I will come closer to Poland, closer to what we are trying in as an embassy to do here in Poland. A couple of years ago, we had the first ever, and until now the last, opinion survey about Israel in Poland, and it showed that the vast majority of Poles know nothing at all. They declared themselves not to know nothing, anything at all, and the vast majority of Poles never saw an Israeli, and the ones who did or who think that they know, in many, according to their answers, it's not. I'm not. Giving an expose about this survey. You could understand that they imagine Israel as some kind of a version of a miestechko, a little shtetl between the wars, which was moved somewhere to the Middle East, and something happens there once in a while. And all our work as an embassy here is trying to show Israel the way Janusz Makuch is showing Israel in the Krakow Festival, which means we are working all the time on contemporary, in two directions, contemporary arts and innovation and technology. In both of them, it's very nice to work in Poland because we have a lot of partners for anything we invent. The last thing we had, which I think was a really real fun, wasn't it? Thing to do. Krakow hosted 2 weeks ago the biggest technology conference, innovation conference, Impact here. And my deputy, who is the creative part of the embassy, invented and implemented the idea of taking over parts of a train from Warsaw to Krakow before Impact, for all the technological people who are going from Warsaw to Krakow. We took three, with the help of everybody on Earth, more or less, from of train company, of Ministry of Technology of Poland, and of Impact itself. We took three wagons in which we had TED Talks and meetings of business people and journalists, and you name it. It was unbelievable that Israeli businessmen are going to show up at 6:40 in the morning for security checkups, but they did, and it was a lot of fun. And the good news, if we are not talking politics right now, is the incredibly growing tourism in both directions. Israelis, somewhere around a quarter of a million Israelis visited Poland last year, and the numbers and around 100,000 Poles to Israel, which is a crazy growth in tourism. And the good part about this tourism, that it's no longer only historical tourism on the one hand and religious tourism to the Holy Land on the other hand, but we have more and more normal tourism. It helped us a lot, not only because tourism puts people together, but it's also when we are working with Israeli businessmen, it's easier for us today because Poland no longer is associated not necessarily with history and camps, but rather with fun and nice city breaks, shopping, whatever. And it's easier for us to bring, we don't have any problems anymore of bringing companies, artists, and so on. So this tourism thing influences everything. And we have today cheap flights from Israel to, you name it, in Poland, from Gdańsk to Rzeszów to Lublin. Krakow, Warsaw were covered always, but today you have a lot of destination. And probably after, I think we started succeeding in convincing that Riba po Żydowsku or gefilte fish is not actually Israeli food. Now we need to explain that hummus is not the only thing we eat in Israel. And in order to have a bit of fun, let's put the little the filmic, and then I hope you'll have some questions.
After 70 years of independence, I thought to myself, what does it mean to be an Israeli? It starts with opening your door to others. My daughter is Israeli. Her grandmother was born in Israel. Her granddad is from Poland. Her nana is from Morocco. And Pops was born in Argentina. Hey, what can I say? We are a melting pot of culture and identity. Being Israeli means getting asked, what do you want to do after high school? After your gap year or uni? When will you settle down? Why don't you have kids? Why just one? Don't you want three? It means getting asked these questions from your mom, your grand, your boss, and even from your cab driver.
לא כדאי לשים לו תינוק גרביים.
To be an Israeli means being certain your kid is the next Messi, but unable to comprehend why the coach didn't put him in the game. It means schlopping after your family on a hiking trip with your dad proclaiming,
כמו שוויץ פה.
To be an Israeli means to proudly sing to yourself in the car while stuck in the same traffic jam every year on your way to the holiday meal. Being Israeli means celebrating Purim, Christmas, Novigod, Ramadan, Passover, Mimuna. It means preparing Moroccan couscous, Hungarian goulash, Yemenite oxtail soup and Polish gefilte fish with a side of Israeli salad and then sitting down with the whole family for a Friday night meal. It also means hearing
תאכל, תאכל, לא אכלת כלום.
And then And then at the end of the dinner, getting endless leftovers to take home. Being Israeli means hearing, I have an idea for a startup, from every single person you meet. It means everyone is family.
אח שלי, נשמה, יפה.
And not waiting in line, ever.
5 דקות אני חוזר.
To be an Israeli means being addicted to the news.
שאבא שלה, זה הרותך.
Terrified of spoilers. Coming to every party at your kid's kindergarten, but forgetting you're on the decoration committee. It's being proud of every Israeli success abroad.
Wonder Woman, אחד.
And always applauding when the plane touches the ground. Being Israeli means arguing what is the best hummus, the best place to shop online, or how a ripe watermelon sounds. It means saying what you want, when you want to, and fighting for the right of those who you disagree with to say complete nonsense. It's coming out from a synagogue and hearing the call to prayer from a nearby mosque. It's volunteering, sharing, and helping those in need wherever you are in the world. And always coming together in times of joy, but also in times of tragedy. Being an Israeli means respecting your past as you look towards the future, and knowing that togetherness will help us overcome any kind of obstacle. Being Israeli means being free to be yourself.
Let's now try...
I will start in English and then end in Polish. You said that you are recently very proud about Israel, that you just passed Japan. We did the same, which in World Cup, which shows there's lots of.
No, it wasn't World Cup. It was. GDP.
I know. That was a joke.
We are lousy in football.
I know.
Really.
I know, but there was lots of Israeli flags on the stadiums in Russia. When you watch it, there was lots of the flags of the fans. The other joke is you are Israel świętuje 70 lat, Polska świętuje 100 lat, my jesteśmy prawie.
Israel is celebrating 70 years of its independence. Poland is celebrating its centenary of independence, so we are almost the same age.
Your 100 is not, it's returning.
The same with you.
Yeah, so we are older.
Okay. Should I speak English or Polish? Okay, będę mówił po polsku.
It's translated anyway.
Okay, so when I finished my 18, I was a young Zionist. I was a strong belief in Zionist idea. So I went to kibbutz. I wanted kibbutz, which you probably know, the kibbutz Dan, and I became even more Zionistic. So next summer, I brought my Polish girlfriend from that time, and to show her Israel. And I was so proud that I took her to kibbutz, to different kibbutz, to show her Israel life. And every we go to the kibbutz Evron, which is next to Naharia. And in my very first day, when we went there, the other volunteer lost his watch. He didn't know where is him. The watch, so he accused me for stealing the watch because I'm from Poland. So after 1 week, I was kicked out from the kibbutz. And he discovered this watch 2 months later, and they informed. But it was a long story because I'm Polish, I was accused of stealing the watch. And after the end of the summer, we went to the Tel Aviv. We rented the cheapest room in the cheapest hostel in Jaffa. And when we enter, I said I'm from Poland. The owner understood that I'm from Poland, of course. But when I showed him the passport, he started to laugh. Why? Because the hostel was full of Poles, illegal migrants, working migrants, and all of them have terrible stories about how they were treated by mafia in Tel Aviv. Like the girls were the passport, the looks passports, because the some mafia want to try to make them prostitutes, and again they were telling this because they are Polish. So I you probably understood that. After this experience, I lost so my heart, not entire heart to Israel, but I understood that it's one of the countries. So now coming to the question. 2 days ago, in joint statement of Polish Prime Minister and Israeli Prime Minister, Israeli Prime Minister said that he is going to fight with anti-Polonism. So how the Israeli Prime Minister is going to fight with anti-Polonism? That's one question. And the second question, at the time when the Morawiecki was giving the speech to the Sejm, exactly this time you were having your own speech in Museum Polin, and you said something, correct me if I'm wrong, that is the last question, that according to the science, which you know, that to change the stereotypes, the personal experience of the different with minorities is the best experience to change the stereotype.
I didn't catch it. Can you do it louder?
So sorry, I can. In Poland, you had the speech on the conference organized by AGC and the Warsaw municipality of Warsaw, and there were mayors of the different cities, and you said something. Something which, as well as I do understand, was the idea was that we need to change the stereotypes also in Poland, and best way to make to change the stereotypes is personal contact, face-to-face contact. But because of the number of the Jews in Poland is so small, we should be more focused on education. Because by education, you can change the stereotypes. So the question is, according to the Children Association, the Krakow Association, and the program, school program, the Jewish topic, I mean, the Holocaust and the history of the Jews in Poland is decreasing in Polish public schools. And then the biggest informal educational program is run by IPN. And if you look on the programs which they offer, on the Jewish, so-called Jewish topics, everything, this is always about the rages between nations, not about the Jews. So what is your idea how Poland should educate about the Jews?
First of all, I think that what happened 2 days ago is very important, but it's not the end of some of the complicated things that happened since the previous IPN novelizacja IPN law was introduced. I am hopeful. I do think that education is the best way to fight all kind of stereotypes. But the fact that the two countries, the two prime ministers signed a joint declaration is very good as a starter. It's not a miracle maker. It's not. It doesn't mean that tomorrow, all the problems which were surfaced, which we guessed that exist, but surfaced 5 months ago, then they are miraculously going to be solved. If you ask me what kind of programs are the best of the. I'm not an educator, but for me, the best and most effective program working today in Poland, it's an NGO program. It's not it's not an official. It's Forum Dialogo, which comes into schools. Talks to children about tolerance, about Jewish traditions and so on, and then works through local projects in their own town or little town or village in recreating the history of the village and trying to be the promoters as young kids. It's either middle school or high school of the idea of tolerance. One can't expect one country to regulate the education of another country, but I do hope that a lot of the really bad things which happened, including a lot of very stupid statements on both sides, which were released during immediately after after the previous EPN law, and I'm talking both sides because as bad as the a lot of anti-Semitic material which was released into public state, which happened in Poland, I think this this promotion, this film about Polish death camps, which was done in the United States and then put on internet and on big billboards in Israel, and stopped, by the way, by Jonathan from Cracker from the JCC, who applied to the people and said, stop it, it's not true. I think that these kinds of things at least are not going to be naturally happening, but what kind of educational things can be done is very complicated, and no one is going to do to be the main critic of what's being done in any of the countries, like critic of mistakes in Israel or critics of mistakes and the historical mistakes in Poland. It can be done only on the basis of internal critique inside Poland, and it's being done because I think that most of the majority of historians who deal with the complicated issues of Poland of Poles in during the World War II are Polish, they are not even Jewish Polish, they are mostly Polish. So it's a long process. Nothing, no miracle is going to happen, but at least we can go first of all to business as usual, and secondly to start having a common language. Whether the Messiah is going to come because of the statement, no, he probably won't.
Thank you very much for your interesting lecture about history of Israel. I have a question about time. When you were an Israeli ambassador in Russia, how Jewish life looks like in Russia? Are Jewish culture festivals in Moscow or in St. Petersburg? And what about relationships between Russia and Israel? If Putin, a good partner for Israeli politics. Thank you.
I'm not sure that a lot of people are very really interested in right now in detailed description of Jewish life in Russia. But it's quite rich and quite open. And you have Jewish festivals and you have Jewish events. You have a much bigger Jewish community in Russia than you have in Poland, obviously. But you don't have not a single Janusz Makuch in the whole of the. So. post-Soviet territory, so I think it's the Jewish festival in Krakow is probably the best. But in Russia as well, there is a lot of activity, including of activity about of current Jewish contemporary arts and a lot of exchange. Now, you said Putin Israel partner. First of all, Putin almost 2 years ago, one happy or unhappy morning, we figured out that he's our neighbor, just like he's your neighbor, because the Russian army is stationed in Syria. Putin is a leader of the biggest country in the world and a country with a very special history. You can have constructive actions or relations with Putin. I don't think that there is even a single country which would define itself as a partner of Putin's Russia. Israel has a constructive relationship. Israel has to have constructive relationship, among other things, when you have the Russians in your neighborhood, when we have a horrible strategic problem inside Syria, including Iranians trying to come closer and closer to our border. We need at least a mechanism, and we have it, a mechanism of deconflicting, meaning, for instance, that when an Israeli plane flies above Syria, that it will not hit a Russian plane because we don't want to be there. So we have a rich, complicated, sometimes constructive, often disruptive relationship with Russia. But to say that we are a partner, first of all, you know, the size-wise, usually partners are supposed to be more or less the same weight. We are not. But the good part about Russian thinking towards us is that a lot of professionals in Russia understood that cutting the relations with Israel in 1967 was a Russian strategic mistake. And that's why the big Russia considers Israel to be an important country in the Middle East, luckily for us. So, and in this situation, we are able to build a relationship, but I wouldn't call it a partnership. Anyone?
Hello. Hello, my name is Tarek, and I'm from the occupied country of Palestine. I grew up in the Israeli occupation 15 years ago, which is still continuing.
You grew up where?
I grew up in Palestine. I grew up in Tulkarm. I grew up seeing terror in my life. I grew up with tanks, jeeps, shootings, with Israeli soldiers around me coming, waking me up every night. I have my uncle murdered by Israeli army in Tulkarm in the Second Intifada 15 years ago. My father was arrested for 3 years in Israeli jails for no reason. My first uncle was murdered in the First Intifada. I still have people who fought for the freedom of my people and the freedom of the Palestinian people. Still, relatives are behind Israeli jails. You spoke a lot about history, but the newer history you didn't speak about. We are still suffering. We are still seeing a continuous occupation of a Palestinian life from every aspect. There is a recognized country now. My question is, there's a recognized country and it's called Palestine. There's a worldwide decision for peace, democratic decision in the UN, and they recognize the state of Palestine and East Jerusalem as it is border. When Israel is willing to fit with this democratic decision and recognize the Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital? And my second question connected to it, Israel is a recognized country in the UN. And every country has borders. Would you define me the borders of Israel? And my third question, which is still connected to it. I lost my mind, but there is a worldwide peaceful organization calling for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions on Israel until it meets international law and recognizing the national part of Israel. There's a big movement inside this movement, and it's called Jewish Voice for Peace, where its members were denied entry to Israel because they support this movement. Israel is calling for a Jewish state now worldwide to be recognized by the Palestinians. There's 9 million Jewish people living outside of Israel. And many, many of them, and the majority of them, they didn't want to move to Israel. And many of them are against Israel and the Zionist ideology. Did Israel take considered the democratic decision of those Jewish people who don't want, who are against Israel and who don't want to be part of this country and ideology, to call Israel as a Jewish state? Thank you.
For the third question, we have a very serious relationship with the Jewish the diaspora around the world. But I don't think anyone who is not a part of the country in which we fight, in which we work, in which we sweat, has any democratic right to decide on the future of this country. And it's when they will come to Israel and become Israeli citizens, they will be welcome to vote for any Israeli party they choose, or to create a new one if they want, but the diaspora is not going to decide on Israel. I can start talking about terrorist organizations, about explosions, about how many Israelis were killed, about shelling of the south of the country by Palestinians. I don't think it's going to bring us anywhere. I think that the only way to settle the argument between Israelis and Palestinians is to, for both sides, first of all, to hold an election. You can say that you don't like the results of the elections in Israel, but we do have elections in a democratic system. On the Palestinian side, I don't see, sadly, I would like to see someone who would be elected and have the guts to sit down. I think the moment people will sit down together, every time good, willing leaders from both sides sat together, whether it was Sadat or even for a short while, not for long, Arafat when he was in this situation, we came to possible solutions. By shelling, creating terrorism, which is, by the way, spreading way beyond the Middle East, we are not going to find a solution. If you ask me when the Palestinian state will happen, the Palestinian state will exist when someone serious will sit and negotiate. We are not going to be solving this issue without negotiations. Doing some really, really cheap propaganda shots, it's not going to help neither you nor us. Anyone? No, there are other people.
Okay. So I'd like to ask a historical question, if I may. So how did Mapai or labor movement leaders in general, how did they deal with the fact that people coming before the war and after it? So for instance, the fourth Aliyah.
Can you repeat and slower?
Oh yes, certainly. So how did the leaders of Zionistic movement and then leaders of Israel deal with the fact that people coming to Palestine or Israel were of Yiddish origins, not the Hebrew ones? So as I see it, there was an incoherence between them and Zionistic view on the nation of Israel. So how did they deal with it? How did they manage to unify the nation?
Well, the people, I don't know what's Yiddish roots, because definitely the first governments of Israel were coming from the same areas. Majority of the people in the government from where Yiddish was spoken. But Yiddish is a language, a vernacular language of parts of European Jewry. Ladino is a language of parts of Sephardic Jewry, and their original language of the Jewish nation, the one in which the Bible was written, was Hebrew. Hebrew was fought for, like just like anything else in Israel. There was a fight for the Hebrew language, and the people actually who introduced the first people who came and introduced the Hebrew language were people very heavily from Yiddish origin. But it's impossible to unite a nation along the lines of a part of this nation. Yiddish was not considered as the unifying nation. On the other hand, Yiddish was heavily spoken in Israel in the first tens of years, 50s. Obviously, people who came with Yiddish as first language were speaking at home Yiddish. But there was a very strong movement to unify, to teach Hebrew and so on, and there was a very strong willingness. There were awkward situations in which kids were even ashamed of their parents speaking any other language than Yiddish. Today, Yiddish, it's very interesting because I think in the last 10, 20, maybe 25 years, there is some kind of a revival of interest in Yiddish, but today it's mostly based on learning it, actually, not from from the street, but rather going to a course or going to the academic course and pick up some Yiddish. But Yiddish is spoken less and less. Can you?
There is a question there behind.
Pani ambasador powiedziała, że tania propaganda nigdzie nas nie zawiedzie.
Now, Madam Ambassador said that the cheap propaganda is not going to take us anywhere. You said that cheap propaganda is not taking us anywhere. It is not quite true. I've spoken with teenagers, 20-something, 30-something. They don't know the history of Israel that you tell us about. Nobody knows about it. Palestinian propaganda is very, very strong in the young generation. They have comic books, social media, rap songs, very strong political figures. And when suddenly, out of nowhere, I come to the defense of Israel, I'm just talking about the existence of Israel is a matter of to be or not to be for the Jews, and I'm being a pariah because Israel is not doing this propaganda. So my question is, will they do? What kind of propaganda? There is one side that says Palestinians are murdered for nothing. There is no counteraction from Israel. The young generation knows nothing. Why do Israelis do that? I can do this and can say that my grandfather was killed by a Palestinian, and my forefather even more. Now, the country is there. We have our channels in the media. Maybe not enough. Also, we are choosing to talk about constructive things, in Poland at least, rather than to use propaganda ping-pong. But in other languages, we do have... We don't want to do propaganda and just speak calmly about what we are doing, what we can do. Perhaps you're right that maybe we need more of everything, but we cannot do everything in Poland. We don't have the pressure, feel the pressure in that direction. We feel more support in Poland than in other European countries.
And I am an educator and leading also and moderating the triangle between three youth organizations.
Germany, Poland, Israel.
Germany, Poland and Israel. And I see the big gap between the relation between Israel and Germany and Israel and Poland, not only on the national level, but also between the youth organizations. I think that 50 years after the first youth agreement between Israel and Germany can give us some lesson also how to cooperate also between Poland and Israel. Can you give us some advices, or do you see the perspective of the cooperation between Poland and Israel also on the youth organization level? Do you see it enthusiastic or
I'll try. And I think it's enough because it's been a long, long time already, so it will be the last one. I do think that you are right and there is a gap. First of all, the basic reason for it is that Germans were working. Germans had, obviously, a horrible problem with working in Israel in its first in the 50s, 60s, and so on. People were actually fighting against relations with Germany and so on. And Germans invested a lot of, among other efforts and money and people, for many, many years of building the program. With Israel-Poland is a bit problematic because both sides are quite spoiled, because Israel-German, usually Germans were taking the main budget for it, and Poland-Germans were taking the main budget for it. Now, how are we going to enlarge the Poland-Israel thing is a very complicated issue. We are trying to do more on youth cooperation through the ministries. I am quite desperate on this issue already. I don't think it works. The only thing that works is school to school, city to city, with enthusiasts who cooperate, because at this point, I couldn't crack neither the Polish Ministry of Education nor mine, I have to admit. So it's only on the level of enthusiasts and local levels, that's the only thing that works. And when we have a school today, a Polish school which wants to cooperate with Israelis, we usually are looking on our own for an Israeli school and not for some kind of a roof organization. So thank you very much.